Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. We are doing the Crusades today. I have Alina with me. Alina, who have you found to come and talk to us?
We have with us today Helena Schrader, who has her PhD from Hamburg University, is a US diplomat, award-winning novelist, historian, written books like Codename Valkyrie, Sisters in Arms, and of course, The Holy Land in the Era of the Crusades, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Helena, onto our podcast.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I think, you know what, I'm just going to kick off straight into these questions because I'm really interested to learning a little bit more about this. So your book is all about altering misconceptions of the region during this period. What would you say has been the popular view?
Well, the aspects that dominate popular perceptions of the Crusades are multiple, but let me just try to focus on the key ones. First, they were fragile, vulnerable, and perpetually on the brink of being either overrun or collapsing. They consisted of large Muslim populations oppressed by a tiny Latin elite or Frankish elite. We use the term Franks regardless of where people came from. There's a Latin elite. And that ruling Frankish or Latin elite were religious fanatics, hateful and intolerant of other religions, and in fact, intent on, you know, mass conversions or even genocide they've been accused of. And yet, because of their small numbers, you see, they were terrified to go out into the countryside, and therefore they lived in walled cities on the coast. And finally, that these Latin nobles were constantly squabbling among themselves. So those are sort of the big overview issues that you see again and again in popular literature. And we shouldn't forget that these views originate not with the general public, but with actually the historians of the previous centuries. What non-historians tend to forget is that historiography itself is evolutionary. So that although the past does not change, our understanding of it does. And simply because the historians of the 18th century were closer to the 12th century doesn't actually mean that they understood it better. Technology can alter our access to critical data about the past. Let me give you just one example, or two examples, if you allow. One is data mining. That with data mining, we can take small little pieces of information and look at it in a way, in a new way, because all of a sudden we can look at lots of pieces of data and create and see patterns that were not necessarily visible to somebody working in the 18th century and you know, looking at only one little record. The other thing that's really, really critical in Crusades historiography is the result of archaeology. There have been major archaeological surveys in what is now Israel in the last 20 to 30 years, which has radicalized our understanding of the Crusader states, because they proved that the Franks actually did have massive investment in agriculture and they didn't live in the cities. They actually lived among the native population without walls. Okay, does that answer your question?
I think that pretty much answers the question. I don't know, what do you think, Alex?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting, isn't it? Because we sort of seem to have, as like you say, a lack of concept of the fact that historiography is evolutionary. So whatever we have been told in the past should be our opinion of something and our perception of something. We take it as being done because the past is done. And I'm in the middle of a complete breakdown on Twitter with an idiot who can't accept that Douglas Haig was on a learning curve along with everybody else in the First World War because he saw Blackadder at some point. But prior to the calling of the Crusades from 1096, give us a sense of how people in the region are living, both culturally and politically. What's happening?
Well, first, let's remember that the region was called the Holy Land, had been part of the Roman Empire for 700 years and was the heart of Christianity. Jerusalem was the holiest city in Christianity for roughly 600 years before it fell to the Muslims in 638. So the Muslim conquest was a dramatic break with the past. Yet what really happens is that all of a sudden this region is no longer the center of a religion. It's peripheral. The religious, cultural, and economic centers of the Muslim caliphate that ruled Jerusalem were in Cairo. They were in Baghdad. They were in Damascus. The holiest cities of Islam are Mecca and Medina, not Jerusalem. Jerusalem is nowhere mentioned in the Quran. Muhammad never physically set foot in the Holy Land. Islamic scholars in the 12th century did not think that Muhammad's night journey started in Jerusalem, something which is now commonly accepted. In the 12th century, it was not believed that Jerusalem was the starting point of Muhammad's ascent into heaven. So this region was politically and religiously insignificant. Suddenly, it became an economic backwater. The other thing, however, tragically, that despite, although it was not central to religion or economy, of the Muslim states, it was in a very important, you know, crossroads. It was along the coast of the Eastern Mediterranean, and therefore it became a bone of contention, a military bone of contention, between competing Sunni and Shia powers in the region. Jerusalem changed hands violently five times after the Muslim conquest and before it falls to the Crusaders. In addition, it was the site of a violent uprising by the predominantly Christian Jewish population against the tiny minority Muslim elite that controlled it. It was a revolt that was brutally put down. It was so brutal, in fact, that other Muslim powers actually condemned the emir that carried it out. So remember, the conquest of Jerusalem in 638 does not start an era of wonderful flourishing. In fact, it's a period in which the area is increasingly declining in importance and, in fact, be subject to desertification. Keep in mind also that while the rulers changed hands, again, it was first the Arabs come in, then the Fatimids come in, that's the Shia Muslims, then the Seljuks come in, the Turks come in, but the population remained Christian and Jewish for the most part. Even 450 years later, when the Crusaders arrive, the population is predominantly Christian Jewish. The Arab population is predominantly immigrant. There's been very, very little conversion, is that what the more recent studies show us. Now, I'm going to step back for a minute. It's true that in the 450 years of Muslim dominance in the Middle East, there was a cultural awakening among the Arabs. There was a surge of creativity. It produced great works of art, literature, mathematics, astronomy. There were advances in many fields, particularly medicine. Baghdad, Cairo, Damascus, as I said, were centers of learning and education. Great mosques, palaces, fortresses, hospitals, and markets were built. And Jerusalem wasn't completely ignored. It was a provincial capital, but yeah, they built the beautiful mosque, which we know the Dome of the Rock, etc. And indeed, the 10th and the 9th and 10th centuries are often viewed as a golden age of Islamic culture. It did impact the region in a peripheral way. But by the end of the 11th century, that golden age was over. The Seljuks had swept in from the steppes of Asia, and although they were recent converts to Islam, they were not Arab in culture or language. They had no great tradition of learning. And the rise of two strong Shia states, the Fatimid Caliphate in Cairo and the Assassins in the Mountains of Lebanon, alarmed Sunni elites about the rise of heresy. The space for theological discourse and discussion, all kinds of intellectual discussion and innovation, shrank in the 11th century. It was most negative, the impact of that changing, that sort of conservative reactionary period in the 11th century was most harmful to the vulnerable groups in society, namely the non-Muslims, the Jimmies, as they're called, the Christians and the Jews and the Zoroastrians, and to women. And a history of this would be a topic in itself, but a history of women in Islam, the 11th century is where they really lose almost all of their rights and their dignity and are confined to the house. And then another important factor just before the Crusades is that the most powerful of the Seljuk viziers, who had basically held this massive Turkish empire together, dies of natural causes in 1092. And what happens is the Seljuk Empire fragments into a mosaic of competing and jealously jealous princes, who are frequently at war with one another. So that when the Crusaders arrive, they're not no longer fighting a unified, powerful, centralized state. They're already facing a fragmented sort of, as they say, patchwork of states where many of the rulers are perfectly happy to ally with the Crusaders against their cousins and their brothers.
It's so fascinating to see it from the other side of that. Do they have any sense of what might be coming? Because as you say, like, if you look at the history of this, religious fighting is not a new concept to these people, is it?
No, of course not. And the Christian term is not actually holy war. The jihad comes right out of the Quran. The Muslims did pursue jihad, holy war, from day one. And it is defined, I mean, this may be going a little off track, but jihad can be defined as the internal struggle against sin, etc. But it has always, and certainly was in the Crusader era, also defined as the fight against the other, as the non-Islamic world. In fact, Islam divides the world into two houses, the house of the Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam, and the Dar al-Harb, which is the house of war. So that in Islamic ideology, the only way to bring peace, the only kind of peace, is to eliminate the house of war, that is to spread Islam to the entire world. And Islamic Sharia law prohibits signing a peace treaty with a non-Muslim. Think about that, okay? On the Christian side, there was no such thing as holy war. Actually, Christ had been very pacifist, and it took them until the 4th century and Saint Augustine to come up with a justification for war, and that was the concept of just war. And it was roughly defined as wars by legitimate authorities, never just by any old buddy, but just only by legitimate authorities, preferably the Pope or a king, against oppression or aggression. So Saint Augustine explicitly, by the way, condemned wars of conversion. And he also condemned the use of excessive force. But the genie was out of the bottle. And of course, secular Christian leaders could now had a theological excuse to go to war, at least in some circumstances. By the end of the 11th century, Western Europe had a well-established tradition of fighting pagans, particularly the Vikings, the Saxons, obviously the Muslims in the Iberian Peninsula. And those wars were considered sanctified, and the men who fought in them could, be sainted. So there's no longer a dichotomy in the Western tradition, the Latin tradition, between being a warrior and being a holy person. By the way, that dichotomy still remained in Byzantium, but that's sort of getting, again, it's getting off our topic. So these wars against pagans were well established, but they were more defensive. I mean, they were the Christian fight to regain control of the Iberian Peninsula, push out the Muslim occupation. They were warding off Viking attacks, but they were not something like crossing 2,000 miles to the other end of the world to liberate a city that had been under Muslim control for 400 years. That said, I want to add, though, that Jerusalem was not really alien to the Christians of the 12th century. Because it was so, they identified so strongly with it as the place of Christ's birth, works, and resurrection. So they remained the spiritual heart of Christendom, but it was physically 2,000 miles away. And that made the Crusades different. I think, well, I mean, we could go into, I could go on for a long time on this. Should we stop?
No, sorry, don't worry. So I want to know, I mean, how does control work in the Holy Lands after the First Crusade? Because it seems that it would have been harder to impose feudalism in the same war. And do we have any evidence of rulers seeking different solutions to governing? I mean, focusing on a little bit more on consent than ties of loyalty and displays of power?
Yeah, bear with me. There's two key factors that dictate the form of government, which evolves in the Holy Land. First of all, it's the tiny proportion of the population that the Crusaders represented in the early years. And secondly, the Christian character of the vast majority of the native population, okay? So Only a handful. Historians estimate only 300, roughly 300 knights, probably less than 300 knights, and maybe 2,000 foot soldiers remained in the Holy Land after the end of the First Crusade. Most of the Crusaders returned once they come. And while those men who remained were recognized as liberators, and to the victor goes the spoils, they were recognized as the people who'd won control of the Holy Land by the native Christian population. So they were recognized as the ruling class. You know, this is an age where people recognize that if you what you win by the sword, you get to keep it. You know, and so the native population didn't have a problem with the Latin Christians taking over the control. But those Latin Christians could not survive without the support of that large Christian population. So they had to find a way of working with them. They couldn't simply impose something on them. And to keep also in mind that this crusade had been explicitly launched to end the oppression of the native Christians. And the Crusaders had treated the Orthodox Christians as brothers all the way along, right along the route. Even when they take Antioch, they free the Orthodox patriarch, they carry him on their shoulders and they reinstate him. They recrown him in his cathedral. This is not, these Christians, I mean, you'll hear, this is one of those misconceptions that the Christians, you know, the Latin Christians oppressed the native Christians. Not true. They have evidence of the Crusaders using Orthodox Christians as their confessors. There's evidence that the churches were shared by Latin congregations and Orthodox congregations. The icons are often dedicated in Latin and in Greek. So they reinstated the patriarchs, they reinstated the bishop. The Crusaders invest massively in rebuilding Orthodox monasteries, as well as Orthodox churches and Latin churches. But both groups worked really, really well together. And yes, there were some rivalry and squabbles between about tithes and titles between the ecclesiastical elites. But the vast majority of the secular society worked together and lived together in amazing harmony. Nothing testifies more to this than the fact that the vast majority of the armies, of the people fighting for the Crusader states against the Muslims in 200 years of warfare were natives. The foot soldiers, the garrisons, the mounted archers were native Christians, not Latin Christians, not Crusaders, not Frankish knights. And they could only do this by not taking away from those people something. You know what I'm saying? Can you follow me? The Latin, they won the loyalty of those locals, including the Jews and the Muslims, by the way, largely by just leaving things the way they were, so that the local economic structures weren't shattered, the trade relations weren't interrupted, civil government and most laws were left in place, unaltered. The Muslims continued to live under Sharia law. The Jews could live according to their laws. Both Jews and Muslims could build houses of worship, something forbidden under Sharia law. You could not build a new house or a new church or a new synagogue anywhere in the Muslim world. But they could, the Jews and the Muslims could under the Christian rulers, and they could practice their religions openly. Muslims could take the Friday as their day off as opposed to Sunday. They could go on the Hajj. The farmers, and then of course, so that's a religious aspect, and believe me, if you leave people's religion alone, most of the time you have them on your side. But the Crusaders went one step farther, is they also did not throw the farmers off their land. They didn't impose new regulations on the shopkeepers or restrictions. The merchants could continue to trade, because the new Latin lords made use of the well-functioning bureaucracy, which had been left in place by the Byzantines and taken over by the Abbasids, and then taken over by the Seljuks. So things like tax collection, port fees, import and export duties, weights, measures, all the little things that make a state function, they were left in place. And they were left, not only did they leave the rules and the laws in place, they left the people administering them in place. This is particularly true when the Crusaders take the island of Cyprus, which had been a part of the Byzantine Empire, and it becomes a Crusader Latin state. But they left all of the Greek bureaucrats in place. Everybody, they just left them there. And they did the same thing largely in the Holy Land. And so everybody who had been a minor bureaucrat continued to be a minor bureaucrat. He wasn't threatened by the Latins. And as I said, the farmer wasn't threatened because he wasn't thrown off his farm. And the merchants aren't threatened because they can still trade. And then what they did, the Crusaders then imposed on this existing substructure and a feudal superstructure, so that the members of the Latin elite, the ruling elite, who were called either burghers if they were non-nobles or the knights and nobles, had their own system of laws and courts that applied only to them. And then they had courts which dealt with conflict between the locals and the settlers or the feudal lords. And it's very complex. Again, it goes beyond, but it worked. The bottom line is that by leaving basically most everything in place as it was, and then adding a superstructure to deal with the immigrants who were Westerners, they created a very stable system.
So to me, this suggests that actually the exchange of ideas, definitely from the perspective of the Latins, they are open to accepting that there are ways of doing things they haven't considered that work, or is it just easy to leave things as they are?
It was both. Yeah. They couldn't. They were too small a minority to have undergone to, and they were too practical. I try to point out that the some of the disputes you hear, you know, like you'll hear if you read church law or church history, that there's disputes between the Orthodox and the Latin Church. No Baron of Jerusalem cared less about how many, you know, angels were dancing on the head of a pin. They were not involved. They were not theocracies. The Crusader states were run by very practical military men, and they were populated primarily by merchants and farmers. They didn't get involved in those kinds of things. Now, in terms of the exchange with the Muslims, that's also an interesting fact, because the Crusaders also showed an amazing willingness and adaptability for, at least for technology and, artistic elements from the East, so that you see them adapting to they're in a different environment. You know, they're used to Northwestern Europe and a lot of rain, and suddenly they're in a desert environment. If they hadn't adapted very rapidly to local ways of agriculture, and of course, massive irrigation and things like that, they couldn't have survived.
So what are the big success stories in the region in terms of peaceful coexistence during the period? Are there any?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the vitality of trade throughout the Crusader era is one of the most dramatic examples of peaceful coexistence. So, excuse me, Muslims who transited the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem, passing from Spain to Mecca and the Hajj, left accounts of how trade was going on even in the midst of military campaigns. You know, that the trade was so lucrative because the Crusader states, I guess I have to add this, once it had been a backwater under the Arab rule, when the Crusaders come in, all of a sudden it's the heart of Christendom again, and there's massive immigration from the West, and there's huge numbers of pilgrims. So they're not necessarily immigrating, but tens of thousands of people visited from the West to the East. There's this booming. It's like it's religious tourism on an enormous scale. But not only that, it's the ports of the Levant are now under the control of Christian rulers, and this island of Cyprus also comes under Christian rule. And you have basically the Western Christian powers controlling almost all of the Mediterranean, not along the coast of Egypt. You sort of had to avoid that. But if you stuck to the north, you were going along to Cilicia and Armenia, et cetera. The control of the sea of the Mediterranean had passed to Christian hands, which made it much safer for ships to travel. And therefore, all of a sudden, all of the riches of the Orient, the silk, the spices, the opium, gold, you know, porcelain, all of these things that would came from further east, from India and China and from Ethiopia, come into the Levant, and there's trade going to Western Europe. And there's this huge demand. Western Europe is also going through a period of economic development. It's booming. People are rich. The middle class is growing. People have a demand for these luxury goods, and they can be met from the Levant, from the Crusader state. The Arabs profit from that. because Christians are controlling the ports, but they can, as long as there's some sort of a truce and they can move goods, they can move their goods from Arabia and, as they say, to India, to the ports and make huge profits in selling them to the West. So there's a symbiotic relationship which develops, particularly in the 13th century, the first half of the 13th century, between the Crusader states and their Muslim neighbors based on trade. And the Ayyubids were very, very reluctant to break it. And they were loath to engage in any kind of jihad because it interfered with their own income and therefore their own lifestyle. And then there's an even more dramatic example. My favorite example, which you may be referring to if you've read the book, is in medicine. Because although the usual assumption is that the Arab medicine was more sophisticated and the Western medicine was barbaric, that theory has been completely debunked by modern scholars who actually looked at the bones and the practices and the medical texts of the period. And they proved that Western, Byzantine, and Muslim medicine were all based on the same classical Greek theories and sources. And they actually identified many cases where Western medical knowledge was superior to that of the Arabs and adopted by the Saracen doctors. But what was happening in the Crusader states was that highly trained and dedicated medical practitioners from all contemporary religions were in the same place. Orthodox, Latin Christians, Jews, Shia, Sunni Muslims, they all lived and worked closely together in that region. And for those without bigotry, and I think most doctors actually are more interested in helping their patient than worrying about their religion, they were anxious to learn from one another. And so they exchanged experiences, techniques, theory, and practice. Under Frankish rule, Antioch blossomed into a major center of for the translation and writing of medical texts, as well as for the study and development of medical theory. And the evolution of medicine and hospitals in the Crusader states is almost a textbook example of how intellectual exchange between different cultures and traditions can stimulate the advancement of all of them. And if I may add a footnote to that, the hospital, which are one of the two, the hospitalers are one of the two major militant orders. They're the Knights of St. John. In their hospitals, they not only employed Jewish and Muslim doctors, they treated Jewish and Muslim patients equally. Their law, their code, their order, required them to swear an oath to help anyone regardless. That's the spirit in which medicine was being practiced in these states.
I have to ask, though, on the reverse side of that, what evidence do we have of stigma, xenophobia, and intolerance on either side?
Well, I actually, can I refer you to a source?
Absolutely.
Niall Christie has published with Routledge, Muslims and Crusaders, Christianity's Wars in the Middle East in 1095, 1382, from the Islamic sources. If you want to read xenophobia and vile language insults, read the Arab sources. Now, that's not to say that the Christians didn't occasionally engage in that, but it's not very evident in the Crusader states. In other words, you are more likely to find xenophobic or intolerant statements in the West than in the Crusader states because they're living so closely. And let me just say, it's impossible for them to have been full of so much hatred and prejudice simply because both sides were engaged near constantly in sophisticated negotiations with one another at a political level, not to mention the training and the economic levels I've already mentioned. And there was a de facto willingness on both sides to treat their religious and strategic enemies with respect and tolerance, at least at the tactical level. And this resulted in the astonishing fact that the Crusader states were at peace more often and longer than they were at war with the states around them. So it's also notable that while the First Kingdom of Jerusalem expanded primarily by force of arms, the Second Kingdom of Jerusalem, well, in case people don't, First Kingdom existed from 1100 to 1187 with the Battle of Hattin. Saladin takes over all of the kingdom except the city of Tyre. And then the kingdom is restored by the Third Crusade. And from 1192 to 1291, it's what we call the Second Kingdom of Jerusalem, where in fact there Jerusalem was never back in Christian hands. And it's basically the coastal area of the Levant where the capital was Acre. That kingdom expanded almost and briefly retook Jerusalem by treaty. So it expanded in the first half of the 13th century almost entirely by diplomatic means. And there's also many instances of temporary tactical alliances between the Crusader states, one or the other, and one or the other of the Muslim states. So the Sultan of Damascus countered his rising enemy in the north in Aleppo, Zengi, by allying himself with the King of Jerusalem. Or more tragically, Jerusalem made an alliance with an Ayyubid prince, the Ayyub prince of Damascus, which is cousin in Cairo, and the Damascene and the Frankish army is defeated by the Egyptians at the Battle of Laforbi in 1244 with devastating results for the Christians. So I couldn't say that you will never find in any source, you know, statements, but the reality on the ground is that they're working and they're cooperating and they're negotiating. And I think it's worth mentioning that while the era of the Crusades was a period of increased anti-Semitism and Jewish persecution in the Western Europe, the Jews in the Holy Land enjoyed freedom from both. There were new synagogues were being built, and Acre became a leading center for Talmudic studies in this period, also Samaritan studies, by the way. And Jews actually immigrated to the Crusader states from both Europe, Western Europe, and Egypt, because it was an oasis of tolerance in an otherwise hostile world, or increasingly hostile world for the Jews.
So Crusaders are a movement with successive waves, some of those waves being larger than others. What kind of impact do these waves have on stability and relations between the Franks and the locals?
Well, the impact of each crusade is different. And I think, you know, I don't know how long we have, but I don't think you really want me to go through that one at a time. But the point is actually that the Crusades were often disruptive and destructive of the equilibrium and the stability that had been established in the Latin East. And one good example of that is, for example, the Second Crusade. It was launched after the loss of the County of Edessa, roughly 50 years, almost half a century after the First Crusade had established the Crusader kingdoms. And it ended up by the Crusaders voting to attack Jerusalem's ally in Damascus. And the Queen of Jerusalem argued against it. The Templars and the Hospitallers argued against it. The barons of Jerusalem argued against it. But King Louis of France and the Crusaders said, no, they were going to attack Damascus. So they went and attacked Damascus, of course, broke up the alliance with Damascus. The Sultan of Damascus then makes friends with Zengi. And, you know, it's a disaster. It's absurd. Another example is the Fourth Crusade, or what we call the Fourth Crusade. It was actually condemned at the time. The Pope considered it an anti-crusade. The leaders of it were excommunicated. But the Fourth Crusade had been called by the Pope and was supposed to come to the assistance of the Kingdom of Jerusalem in 1203. But the Crusaders ran out of funds when they got to the Italian port of Venice. So the Venetians suggested they could pay off their debt by hiring themselves out as mercenaries in the interest of Venice. And Venice ends up capturing, and they, in the service of Venice, end up capturing Constantinople. That ends up, of course, diverting people, men, arms, all sorts of things to Constantinople. Whereas, you know, Jerusalem, that's not in Jerusalem's interest. So, the Sixth Crusade is another great example where it, again, another one of the Crusades, we call it a crusade. The Pope also called it an anti-crusade, condemned it, excommunicated the leader. But, you know, so Frederick II Hohenstaufen comes out to the Crusader states, makes a sloppy truce with the Arabs that leaves Jerusalem weaker than ever before, and then departs and leaves, and what ensues is a civil war. So, yeah, the short, you know, the objectives and the attitudes of Crusaders from the West were certainly not always aligned with those of the Franks living in the Crusader states. Sometimes they were. I mean, to be fair, the Third Crusade, of course, restored the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So it's not that they were always at odds, but they were not always aligned.
How do you see the situation change across successive generations?
Thank you. Thank you for asking that question, because people so often forget that things do change over 200 years.
Yeah, we just go, Crusades, the end. But it's a huge wave of time.
I still get questions, you know, in the time. Well, in the Middle Ages, what did you say? Like, yeah, in what part of that 1,000 years do you want me to talk about? So the city situation to change. And in the first kingdom of Jerusalem, in the early years, that first 100 years was characterized, as I mentioned, by substantial Christian and Jewish immigration. And they were not when I talk about immigration, I don't mean crusaders coming and going. I mean individuals, often as they came as crusaders, they came as pilgrims, but then decided to settle in the region. And the early kings actually consciously invited settlers, including settlers from the neighboring Muslim states. So they actually were inviting other Orthodox Christians. They were increasing their Orthodox population. Because the region had been so seriously depopulated and neglected during in Muslim rule. And as I say, much of the fertile parts of the region had been lost to desertification. So the Franks started a massive investment in such things as water mills, roads, water mills, and irrigation mills to feed irrigation ditches, which enabled lands that had been left fallow to be brought back under cultivation. And that enabled new arriving settlers to take over new land rather than displacing natives. So when you look at the patterns, again, this is some of the things we learned from the archaeology, from the archaeological studies rather than from the chronicles. You can see that the native population often lives in the valley, and the new Latin settlements are built around on the fringes of that. So they don't displace people. They don't throw them out of their homes. They don't take them off their fields. Or they would build a Frankish castle, which would defend the entire region or serve as an administrative center. And the Latins would build their houses around the base of the castle, leaving the native population where they were in the valley. That's one thing that's going on. The other thing that's happening is that most of those settlers, at least in the early years, were men. So what did they do if they settled down? You want to start a family, you marry the natives. And back to the fact that because the natives were Christian, that was possible. Had the population really been predominantly Muslim, that would not have been possible. The laws were very rigid on both sides. The Muslims obviously would have killed any Islamic woman who slept with a Christian, and the Christian church at the same time required that the wife be Christian. But they could be Orthodox Christian. So you had this massive amount of intermarriage between the settlers, the Western settlers, and the native women, and the next generation already is speaking both languages. So that by the second, third, fourth generation, the late Latin Christians often spoke Arabic and Syriac as well or better than they spoke French. And even among the feudal elites, you have scholars like William of Tyre, who's writing a history of Islam. He wrote a history of Islam based on the Muslim Arabic sources. Or you have one of the lords of Evelyn, Baldwin the Evelyn, writing, translating Arabic poetry into French. And lower classes were fluent because they were trading and dealing with it. And as I said, they knew their mother's language as well as their father's language. And with time, that's reinforced. So the next generation, the half-bloods are intermarrying with themselves or again marrying more natives. And they're adopting the clothing, which is suitable to the climate. They're adopting the cuisine because they're using locally available products, ingredients, literally the spices of the Orient and exotic fruits like oranges and lemons and figs and pomegranates. And inevitably, and they're adopting, as I say, artistic elements. The icons became very, very popular in the region. And they built in stone rather than in wood because that was more common. Wood was a rarity in the East. So the houses are built in stone and marble, and they use mosaics and features that we associate with the East and with Byzantium. And they evolved their own culture so that by the 13th century, the Franks living in the East were quite different, not only in their outlook, but as I say, in their culture from the Crusaders coming from the West.
Thank you so much. That was so enlightening and really interesting. I've been saying this a lot actually on the podcast, but I'm seriously learning a lot. Stepping back from World War II history, I'm stepping back into something completely different, totally out of the box. So thank you so much for this. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you for this opportunity. I hope it'll inspire some people to look more into it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.